Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry Truman, Bernard M. Baruch, Senator Robert Taft, General George C. Marshall, Governor Earl Warren, Mary Martin, Ezio Pinza, Harold Stassen, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 23rd performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
People in Asia are dying of hunger, and the best-selling books in America are How to Get Thin.
It is with tremendous pride and with unbounded appreciation of his valor and his love of country that I present to you the world's greatest statesman and the next president of the United States.
Sometimes you wonder if you'll ever get home again. And then it happens. You're home. Your wife, your baby, everything you've been wanting, suddenly it's real. It's yours.
Hear it now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for ear based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
The nation's writing arm and the post office were still overtaxed. The letters to the editor, to your congressman, to the president, had in the 5 weeks since MacArthur's dismissal broken all records. Even the most addressed man in the world told of the huge stacks that awaited him at the White House every day.
You see things in the paper, write your president, and I get 40,000 letters a day. As a result of that, on special occasions...
Beginning, most congressmen, editors, and commentators reported that the pro-MacArthur mail far outweighed the pro-Truman mail. This week at the annual dinner of the Overseas Press Club, two editors with no little unanswered mail reported on the trend of their most recent letters. First, Mrs. Helen Rogers Reed of the New York Herald Tribune.
Perhaps a slight barometer of thinking in and near New York on the great debate would be through the mail received by one newspaper. Emotion was at white heat, of course, and the ratio of letters received in favor of General MacArthur started at 30 to 1. It went down to 3 to 1 and has been decreasing until it's nearing parity now.
H.V. Kaltenborn reported on his mail.
I think we've all had the experience that the MacArthur mail was almost unanimous in his favor at the beginning and then dropped off until now. It's much closer to parity, although I must say that my experience is still that my mail runs at least 20 to 1 in MacArthur's favor.
At the Overseas Press Club dinner were many of the top editors and reporters of every field of journalism. They, like most Americans, spent a large part of the evening arguing about the great dismissal. Hal Boyle of the Associated Press, who spent most of the past 11 months on the Korean front, said this.
A distinguished friend of mine from the New York Times, a gentleman from the New York Times, Washington Bureau, said that the current quip in Washington is about the old soldier fading away. He's not fading away. He's just fading and waiting till he can get the dice again.
Gideon Seymour of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune said he spoke for the people of the Midwest.
Now, the people of the Middle West realize that in this long struggle, Korea is only an incident, albeit an important incident. They want an American foreign policy that is a world policy, not just a European policy, and certainly not just an Asiatic policy. They have felt that the administration wrote off too casually, almost even eagerly, our vital interests in Asia and the Pacific. They have welcomed the MacArthur tumult because it has stiffened the administration's resolve to protect our Asiatic interests and to re-examine what those interests are. They don't think MacArthur is right, but they think that he has impelled correction of a tendency to make too easy concessions to communism in Asia.
And Barry Bingham of the Louisville Courier Journal and Times said that he spoke for the people of the South.
There is plenty of MacArthur sentiment in the South today. Yet when I studied the press recently to see the reaction to the firing episode, I found somewhat more support for the administration in Southern papers than in the press generally. The South, I think, is a little less subject to mass hysteria than the rest of our nation. We have fewer people in the South who believe that America can live alone and go on living at all.
Bob Considine of International News Service, author of a book called MacArthur the Magnificent, said this.
We all hear the great debate. There's no more great debate. The administration has come around to MacArthur's thinking very vividly, I think. There's no great differentiation. There's no great cleavage anymore. Marshall said yesterday that he certainly believed in saving Formosa. The day after MacArthur got back, we sent a team of experts to Chiang Kai-shek to train those guys. The British, at great sacrifice, have stopped selling rubber to Red China, which is a part of the general blockade that he had called for. But it seems to me that in these 300,000 or 400,000 words that have been said, that the boys have finally talked themselves into the same point of view.
And author and editor Quentin Reynolds, who said he had never met Truman or MacArthur, had this theory.
I don't think General MacArthur needs any defense from his enemies, heavens knows. But I do think he needs a defense against some of his friends. I mean the idolatrous supporters who surrounded him during the past few years, who attribute to him all the wisdom and virtue under the sun without any of the faults which ordinary human flesh is heir to. Now, if you tell one of these men, and we've all met the members of the general's staff, that General MacArthur is really human, and if he's cut, he actually will bleed, they rise in indignation and say, you're smearing the greatest warrior that ever lived. If you grant General MacArthur's great personal courage, and only a fool would say nay to that, and if you grant his competence as an officer to them, they say indignantly that you're belittling him. I think General MacArthur's greatest enemies are those who purport to speak for him these days, especially those in Washington.
The gentlemen of the press and radio were perhaps a bit more articulate, but able to reach no more definite conclusions than any of the 700 people assembled in the same room. Actually, the only definite conclusion reached was that an ancient political proverb quoted by editor Gideon Seymour from Minneapolis made enough sense to be re-quoted twice during the evening.
Fisher Ames, congressman from Massachusetts, date 1794. A monarchy is like a merchant ship. It sails the seas proudly, but if it strikes a rock, it will sink. A republic is like a raft. It will never go down with you, but your feet are always wet.
The raft was rocking in the Senate caucus room this week. The senators looking into the MacArthur case spent more than 2 days debating a constitutional issue. Does a confidential advisor to the president have to tell Congress about his confidential talks with the president? The advisor was General Omar Bradley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On Monday, he told the senators that General MacArthur's plans for Asia would involve us in the wrong war, at the wrong place, at the wrong time, and with the wrong enemy. Then, General Bradley refused to tell the committee what went on at the White House discussions on dismissing MacArthur. The senators argued and then voted, 18-8, to let General Bradley keep his talks with the president a secret. Republican Senator Noland of California was unhappy over the decision.
There is grave danger that the action taken by the committees today will present the committee with an iron curtain blocking off certain information which they will need in order to discharge their duty to the Senate and to the nation. If this precedent holds with other witnesses, it is entirely possible that the same defense will be made relative to the Yalta Conference, the Potsdam Conference, and the meetings in the Blair House, which led up to this country being committed to the Korean War. Certainly, this question of a confidential relationship, if carried to that extreme, will block the Senate and the country from having information which they need to arrive at sound conclusions.
But Republican Senator Flanders of Vermont doesn't think the committee set any precedent for the future.
It was difficult to decide what was the right thing on this vote. I stated that I would not want to be a party to setting new precedents which would weaken the authority of Congress to get needed information. I became assured that we could still be insistent on other occasions in this hearing. The trouble in making the fight on this instance is that the relation between General Bradley and the president is, by law, a confidential one. The same conditions will not apply to the other witnesses who will come before us.
And Chairman Russell, a Democrat, was pleased at the support the committee had given him.
I think that the decision of the committee is eminently correct, not only because I made the decision, but because it is supported by the great weight of constitutional authority. These issues are important, more important than the individuals who happen to occupy offices now, because if any one branch of the government obtains an undue advantage over another and is able to impinge upon its rights, it threatens our wonderful system and our fundamental freedoms.
The committee invited General Bradley to return to the witness chair on Monday. And then the president made it known he had been considering dismissing General MacArthur since last August. It was no hasty decision. And Secretary of State Acheson had originally opposed the move on the grounds it would kick up a political fuss. Mr. Truman acknowledged the firing of MacArthur had done that.
Red, white, and yellow, roads are high.
The music you hear is a hymn being sung by the Corps of Cadets of the Virginia Military Institute as they honored their most illustrious graduate, the Secretary of Defense, George Catlett Marshall. For the general, it was undoubtedly a welcome respite after more than 7 days on the witness stand before the joint committees. He spoke of confusions and a free press.
What a tremendous development has taken place, and how confused, as they often say, the public is. You can't move at that speed without some confusion, and you certainly can't move at that speed with a free press without considerable confusion. Now, understand me, I'm in no way reflecting on a free press. That's a vital necessity in this country, but it touches your vitals every now and then.
Also on the platform at VMI was elder statesman Bernard M. Baruch, an old friend of General MacArthur as well as General Marshall, but who has broken with President Truman. To date, Mr. Baruch had not indicated his position on the controversy, but on Tuesday, he left little doubt as to where he stood.
I wonder how much of the controversy in recent days is really a reflection of the difference between the leader of troops and the organizer. A great leader of troops, naturally, is zealous in desiring that when his men become locked in battle, that every resource be marshaled which might increase the chance of their winning or of decreasing their losses. The very qualities which made him so valiant a leader of troops would make him impatient of any limitations on his action. But the organizer has to think not only of the men fighting in the one front, but of all the fronts of war and defense. He must weigh each theater and its relative importance upon the scales of a globe-flung strategy. Today, as Secretary of Defense, George Marshall, perhaps under even more difficult conditions, is called upon to devise the global strategy which will bring us victory in the peacemaking.
Later, Mr. Baruch, who has been right as often as most men who make public pronouncements, suggested a solution for this controversy.
Many of the issues and choices raised by the controversy would solve themselves if more of America's strength were mobilized. Until we have mobilized, few, if any, of the issues have been raised can really be solved. There is strength in unity, but there's also unity in strength. We, our allies, as well as this country, must first grow stronger militarily before we can have a unified foreign policy. In Korea, today we are buying time.